Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, bullets or ballots for Zimbabwe. Church leaders in the region denounce the violence and describe the planned election as a sham. And Christians in a post-Soviet society. Ukraine celebrates its first ecumenical social week in Lviv. Stay tuned. South Africa's elder statesman Nelson Mandela has added his voice to the chorus of international condemnation over the widespread violence and political intimidation in neighbouring Zimbabwe. Mandela on Wednesday said the country was suffering from a tragic failure of leadership as President Robert Mugabe prepared to go ahead with a runoff presidential poll on Friday. South African leaders holding an emergency summit in Swaziland, meanwhile, appealed for the vote to be called off since they said current conditions cannot guarantee a fair or free vote. Earlier this week, opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai withdrew from the ballot in an effort to stop the violence and called for international help to end the current crisis. Tsvangirai's Movement for Democratic Change, or MDC, says over 80 of its supporters have been killed and 200,000 more forced from their homes by militias loyal to the ruling ZANU-PF party. The government, meanwhile, blames the MDC for the violence. Church leaders in the region have also spoken out strongly this week against the planned election, calling it a sham and accusing the ruling ZANU-PF party of barbaric atrocities. In a statement, the Southern African Catholic Bishops' Conference said the politically motivated violence, intimidation and torture have made a just and fair runoff election virtually impossible.
There's an enormous amount of suffering going on. So our first concern is to express our solidarity with the church and with the people of Zimbabwe.
Cardinal Wilfred Napier is Archbishop of Durban and spokesperson for the Southern African Catholic Bishops' Conference.
The second intention of the statement is to call on SADC in particular and the international community in general to start taking action before there is a wholesale humanitarian crisis in Zimbabwe, which is going to envelop the whole of Southern Africa.
Now, this violence has been going on for some time. There are those who say the church in South Africa should have spoken up months ago. What's your response to that?
We do believe that there should have been a much more louder condemnation of what was being done, particularly by ZANU-PF, and I think even worse still, by the agents of the state who should be protecting people, not trying to keep a particular party in power. And yes, we believe that they should have been taking action a long time ago.
You're calling this election runoff a sham. You're talking about atrocities and the barbaric behaviour of the ruling party. Have you had reactions from the political leadership there at all to this?
I don't think they would even give us an answer because it's been said before. And probably if they were to answer, they would give us the same answer they're giving to the statement from the United Nations, where they simply say this isn't a reflection of what's truly happening. But the evidence that we have been able to hear for ourselves is that of those who have been injured and killed during this the unrest there, there are very, very few, if any, ZANU-PF members that are involved, that have been the victims, should I say. So for us, it's quite clear that the government is going to deny, first of all, that the situation is as bad as we're saying it is, and secondly, that they have anything to do with it. But they're certainly not doing anything to stop it from happening.
You say these atrocities and the barbarism is being documented and that justice awaits. Can you tell us anything more about what kind of documentation is going on to eventually try and help victims?
One of the first things that we did after the elections and we got wind that there was this kind of intimidation, it was started off as intimidation and then there was violence against those who either had voted for the MDC or who had been perceived to have favored the MDC as electoral officers and so on, and where MDC had beaten ZANU-PF in traditional ZANU-PF areas, they became the victims then. Many of those people came down to South Africa, to Botswana, and to other countries to seek refuge. And it was from them, whenever we got any information that they had been involved, that they had been the victims of such violence, we asked them to write out affidavits. So we've done something down here, and we know that there are other parties in Zimbabwe who are doing the same, notably the Catholic Church's Justice and Peace Commission.
The South African political leaders there, and indeed most African leaders, have been very, very slow and unwilling to speak and to act to try and save the situation there in Zimbabwe, haven't they? What is your view on this?
Well, it's one of these situations where were they afraid that if they spoke out too forcefully, they would be had fingers pointed at them for not observing, respecting human rights as well. But strangely, in the last few days, especially since the United Nations statement, many, many more African leaders, Southern African leaders, seem to be coming out and saying that this is intolerable, it cannot be allowed to continue happening. That for us is a sign that at least now Morgan Tsvangirai's withdrawal from the runoff election seems to have triggered a reaction that has woken up some of the leaders to the reality that they cannot continue pretending that everything is okay when it's so terribly wrong.
Do you see then that Morgan Tsvangirai's move was a very positive one, the right thing to do in this desperate circumstance?
You know, he probably was more aware than we are of what extent his own followers and other innocent people were being victimized, and I think in conscience couldn't go ahead and pretend as if the election is actually going to be free and fair, and that the conditions for people to freely and conscientiously express their wishes by putting voting for the man they wanted to represent them or to lead them. I think he had to do it. It was commendable that he would do that.
He has called for a military force to be sent in to try and keep the peace there, almost a declaration of civil war. What is your reaction to that?
Well, I think that the way things are going, we have a virtual civil war already going on, except that it's a civil war that's been conducted by one side and there's hardly any reaction. Certainly there doesn't seem to be any violent or armed reaction from the other side, even though there are people like the spokespeople for ZANU-PF or for the Zimbabwean government who are trying to make out as if the MDC is responsible for the greater part of the violence. I'd be very surprised if there aren't isolated instances where ZANU-PF supporters have been attacked or have been subjected to a reaction from the other side. But by far, the weight of evidence is that it's the ZANU-PF and the organs of state that are perpetrating the violence.
We heard Pope Benedict just a little while ago at the United Nations talking about the crucial responsibility of the international community to protect people who are not being protected by their own governments. And this seems to be a clear example of that. Do you think these words, do you think there is anything else that the church in any way can do to try and persuade the international community to act in this direction?
Philip, I am not sure that we can do much more than keep on calling and maybe contacting people that we believe can do something, such as the embassies of the various countries that have an interest and have an influence over that. And I'm sure within the next few days that's what our office in Pretoria will be trying to do. We have been engaging in a campaign of prayer. We're having prayers at almost all our masses for a peaceful outcome to the solution or restoration of peace, and a peaceful and just outcome to whatever election process is going to take over when this one has been declared to be what it is, a sham. And so the main thing I would ask of people over, all the world over, is that we continue praying earnestly for a change of heart on the part of Mugabe, as the leader who has it in his hands, actually, to bring about a change there. And then all the others who have been carrying out these atrocities, that they would also have a change of heart and start respecting their brothers and sisters, whom after now they've been showing complete contempt for.
We do believe very much that the way in which God acts in the world, the way in which providence and the Spirit moves, is how history is created. So we believe in the power of prayer to transform people. We would say even many of the perpetrators of violence are themselves victims who need transforming, and that the power of prayer is part of how such people can be transformed.
John Stewart is director of a Zimbabwean human rights NGO and part of an umbrella organization of aid and development networks, which has also issued a statement urging international intervention to protect the people of Zimbabwe.
We start from the point of view that the normal protection that should be accorded by policing and security services within Zimbabwe is entirely absent, because those services are being used to support and to promote the militia and state security attacks on ordinary people, particularly members of opposition parties or suspected non-supporters of ZANU-PF. What exists within Zimbabwe in terms of civil society and international diplomatic presence is entirely inadequate to replace that protection. But what we're really talking about is the removing of the capacity for the violation of people's rights, for the violence to be delivered, especially by the militia-type structures, for that to be removed. And so when we talk about an intervention capacity, we're talking about a capacity coming into the country in a way portraying itself as not threatening existing institutions, but carrying out the role of disarmament, demobilization, disbanding of militia units, assisting of other army units to return to the discipline of barracks and the rule of the Defense Act of Zimbabwe. So we do see the need for a peacemaking intervention to begin with, in the context, and we would emphasize this, in the context of creating or moving towards creating adequate security conditions for a free and fair election. Because our perspective is entirely that a process needs to take place which enables a choice by the people, a proper electoral process, so that the people can make a choice of the leadership of the country without constraint and without coercion. And so the security aspect is what we are talking about, that statement is talking about. Clearly there are other issues, such as the restoration of an independent judiciary, the creation of an independent media, the non-partisan humanitarian support for the people's survival. But a key component, we think, needs to be the process of removing the threats to people's physical security that are constituted by the armed and violent militia groups and their military and police support. We called on churches worldwide, with the help of our partner organizations, to organize this day of prayer for peace and justice in Zimbabwe. And Mr. Mugabe himself comes from a Catholic Church background, was educated by Jesuits and involved in Catholic youth organizations when he was younger. So, and he recently made a statement that God brought him to power and only God can remove him from power. And of course, we do believe very much that the power of prayer is part of how such people can be transformed.
John Stewart there, director of a Zimbabwean human rights NGO. And earlier you heard Cardinal Wilfrid Napier, Archbishop of Durban and spokesman for the Southern African Catholic Bishops' Conference. Catholics in Ukraine joined with other Christian churches recently to celebrate the first ecumenical social week in the western city of Lviv, an ancient crossroads of East and Western cultures and religions. The initiative, modelled on the French Semaine Sociale, was jointly organised by the Ukrainian Catholic University and the Lviv City Council, in partnership with the Vatican's Justice and Peace Council, the World Council of Churches and other organisations. Its aim was to improve relations between and encourage participation in Christian and Jewish social organisations, and to present Christian social teaching as a source of practical solutions for some of the problems of contemporary society. Events included everything from conferences and roundtable discussions to rock concerts, exhibitions and theatre performances.
And people came. I would prefer to have much more people, but you know, it was the maybe, I would say, 10,000 people who were at these events.
Antoine Arzhakovsky is director of the Institute of Ecumenical Studies, set up in 2004 as part of the Ukrainian Catholic University in Lviv.
We have lots of good news. The first good news is that we received the blessing of all Christian churches in Lviv, which is for me very important, because sometimes people think that Western Ukraine is a problem for ecumenical dialogue. But in reality, if we meet the bishops and if we speak about what is important for Christians and the priority is to fulfill the gospel, to help the neighbor, so then they agree and they say, yes, of course, we may have some theological disagreements, but on the most important, we agree. And I was happy to not only receive the blessing, but also all the bishops came, from the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, Moscow Patriarchate, from the Greek Catholic Church, from the Roman Catholic Church. The nuncio came from Kiev and Protestants also, and different other Orthodox churches, so Armenian Church. Everyone came and spoke and said good words of the necessity to work together for prisoners, for people with disabilities, for children who are in the streets, things like that. So this is for me the first good news. Then, among the other good news for us at the Ukrainian Catholic University, at the Institute of Ecumenical Studies, it was the first time that we were working closely with the city hall of Lviv and with the region of Lviv, but also with Katerina Yushchenko, who is the First Lady of Ukraine and the president of the Foundation Ukraine 3000. And so there was a sort of cooperation between civil society and state structures, and these state structures also put money in the project. It was not only, you know, words, but concretely they gave also financial support to the project. And that allowed us to bring 40 associations, social charities, like the Caritas, of course, but many others, 40 of them, and not only Christian. We were, for instance, in a Jewish social organization, Chesed Aryeh, and it was good to meet the old people who were gathered there, and this organization is working with them. Then lots of events happened during the week, you know, because it was a conference, for instance, an academic conference on the cooperative movement, which is not only a Ukrainian movement of the beginning of the 20th century. It's everywhere at the beginning of the 20th century in Europe, in Canada, in the States. It was a sort of third way between liberal capitalism and socialism, Marxism. It was the idea of promoting subsidiarity, responsibility, solidarity of the community. And today, Michel Candessu came. He was the previous general director of the International Monetary Fund. He came to say, this is very actual. It's not only the past, it's the future. And this is exactly what Mohamed Yunus, the Nobel Prize, also said many times, with the importance of the credit unions, the microcredit, that kind of thing. things.
Would you say that perhaps these events mark a new stage in the relationship between the church and the government? You mentioned the support of national institutions and national politicians. Is this a beginning of a new development in the relationship since the post-Soviet period?
I think so, because really all the people around me told me how important it was. It's a premiere, really, and it's possible in Lviv, because in Lviv there is a desire of putting together Christian principles, but also to work in a European way of respecting all the viewpoints, the freedom of consciousness. There is an awareness of this difficulty that is not easy to solve in Western Europe or Canada or in America. Here the idea is to invent a new model of relationships between state structures and civil society, and the main idea is to put things in an ecumenical way. If churches may find an agreement, a consensus on main issues, for instance, we spoke about the necessity to rewrite the law on tax law on social organizations. So if there is a consensus between churches on main subjects, then it's easier for state structures that they remember, of course, that the Christians are the big majority of the citizens of Ukraine, to fulfill the proposals from this forum, this network. We created an expert committee with the experts from different churches, different organizations, states and civil organizations. And we published a declaration on Friday, which was at the press conference. And in this declaration, some proposals were given to the political leaders who came, because there was not only Katerina Yushchenko and the local leaders, but also from Kiev, the head of the Christian Democratic Party, who is deputy at the Rada, Mr. Stretovich. We gave them this text with concrete proposals also how we plan to work together and how we will create, for instance, a master program in ecumenical studies which will form social worker, and how it could be a model not only for Lviv but for other universities in Ukraine.
You say that the churches have a shared vision around these social issues, and yet, as you mentioned, there are also many problems, many obstacles, aren't there, between the different churches, particularly between the Orthodox and the Greek Catholic Church there in Western Ukraine?
Well, there is some difficulties connected with the past. You know, there is the idea that the Greek Catholic Church says that the synod of 1946 that eliminated this church was not a real synod. This is the position of the Greek Catholic Church. And the Orthodox Church, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which is connected with the Moscow Patriarchate, says, no, it was a real synod, and this church asked to come back inside the Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate. And still now, it's a real problem that there is not a consensus on what happened during the Soviet time. And because of that, lots of problems arose in the 90s when freedom came and there was a necessity to share the building, the churches. So I would say that on the level of buildings, of properties, now it's easier. The crisis is behind us. But on the level of mutual recognition, it is still not solved. And that's why at the Institute of Ecumenical Studies, with our students, we write lots of theses, master theses, on concrete issues that happened in the 90s. And we show that, in fact, the problem was not really interconfessional. It was often connected with many other problems. Sometimes, for instance, it was inside the Orthodox Church, between the Kievan Patriarchate and the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, Moscow Patriarchate, that problem appeared. Or when it was between the Greek Catholics and the Orthodox, it was not necessarily the desire of the bishops, and often Bishop Augustine, who is the head of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, Moscow Patriarchate, says, I have no problem with the bishop, the Greek Catholic bishop of Lviv, Monseigneur Igor Wozniak. I have no problem with him. The problem is mainly with the state authorities, with the city hall, which doesn't give me the possibility to build a church. So when you go in the detail, you see that the picture is different, and it's too simple to reduce this conflict as a confessional, interconfessional conflict. So the social week is the possibility for these churches to work together, to know much more each other, to remember that the problem is not often between them, but is connected with other causes. And that, I hope, little by little, will help us to come back to this main difficulty of understanding the past, understanding the history and healing the memories.
You say that Ukraine is still predominantly a Christian nation, and yet it is facing some of the same problems of secularism that is facing most of the former Soviet countries, isn't it?
Well, my opinion is that Ukraine has a Christian culture, and that Ukraine has a majority of baptized Christian people. But I would not say that Ukraine is a Christian country. I would say, on the contrary, that after the Soviet time, after so many years of persecutions and of official atheistic ideology, Ukraine is in a very bad situation, and the secularization of the Soviet time received a second wave from the 90s. And when you look at different figures, for instance, well, all the questions, the social problems of the development of AIDS, or the difficulty to for the churches to work socially, or the attendance of on Sunday at liturgies or Messa, you see that there is a big problem of communication between churches, official institutions, structures, and the population, the people. So there is a desire from Ukrainians to come back to a sort of post-confessional and a new Christian era, but they don't know how to do. The leader of the party of the regions, they all said publicly that they believe in God, in Christ, and so on. But then how to teach, for instance, Christian ethics in the school, they didn't find agreement how to do that. So there is lots of things to do together. If there is a ecumenical consensus, for instance, on how to teach Christian ethics, then they will do that, because they really want to create a new society grounded on Christian principles. And that's exactly what Katerina Yushchenko said during her speech at the Ecumenical Social Week.
Many thanks there to Dr. Antoine Arzhakovsky, director of the Institute of Ecumenical Studies at the Ukrainian Catholic University in Lviv. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.